From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. God, money, and politics. There are three things that can make for tense conversations at the dinner table. Well, a news story brewing out of the nation's capital combines all three. Last year, the Senate Finance Committee launched an investigation into six megachurches. They're suspected of misusing tax-exempt funds. The government asked the ministries to explain how they spend the money they take in, and some of those expenses include million-dollar homes, luxury cars, private jets. Well, Monday was the deadline to hand over their books. Only four of the six churches complied. For the latest on the investigation, we've got NPR senior correspondent Juan Williams. Hey, Juan.
How you doing, Farai?
I am doing great. So specifically, why are these churches being investigated?
Well, what you have is an extraordinary amount of spending. Maybe the best known of these ministers might be Kenneth Copeland, the televangelist. And when you look at his church and several of the others, what you see is evidence of the so-called prosperity gospel, Farai, in which you've got people with, you know, yachts and mansions and extraordinary spending going on. And that caught the attention of the Senate Finance Committee, in particular Chairman Charles Grassley of Iowa, who was looking for these people to justify their spending because, remember, they're tax-exempt. And so the Senate Finance Committee is arguing that, in addition to IRS inquiries, the Senate Finance Committee has every right to look into this issue as to whether or not the tax-exempt status of the church is being violated in spirit, if not in law.
Some of these ministers are saying that the IRS should handle this and the Senate should not be involved at all. How is that debate playing out?
Well, so far, there's no debate. There's an argument being made by the lawyers for some of the ministers, but it's not gaining any traction with the Senate Finance Committee, which argues that they have, in addition to the IRS, that they have jurisdiction over tax-exempt policy, which is exactly true. I mean, they control, and to that extent, the IRS, they set policy. So unless this gets into the courts and there's some kind of determination that, in fact, the Senate Finance Committee has overstepped its bounds, what we're really waiting on now is simply for the other four churches to supply the information requested by the Senate Finance Committee. Two of the churches, as you pointed out, have sent in information to be evaluated as to whether or not they have exceeded the bounds of their tax-exempt status.
So talk a little bit about Kenneth Copeland and Creflo Dollar. What are their sort of approaches to this request?
Well, and as I mentioned, in Kenneth Copeland, the televangelist, and Creflo Dollar, who's another televangelist, but he's from suburban Atlanta, Copeland being from Texas, are making the case that whatever the relationship is between a minister and the congregation, it's none of the business of the U.S. government, and that they have overstepped their bounds. Now, I must tell you that the faith healer Benny Hinn, as well as Joyce Meyer, who heads another group in St. Louis in Missouri, have submitted answers to Grassley's questions. And then you have the resistant forces coming from the likes of, Creflo, for example, and Ken Copeland. And their argument really comes down to it's a private relationship. If someone chooses to worship in such a way that they give God's bounty back to the church, no matter what, to what extent, it is between that person and their spiritual advisor, their minister, and should not be subject to the scrutiny, the inquiries of the U.S. government.
So some of them have turned in the information on time. Some of them are still pending, and some of them are just kind of waffling. Is that correct?
That's right. And what you hear is that there's a real sense, I think you hear this most directly from, some of the lawyers, that this is a real attack. It's an attack by people who don't like the prosperity gospel. They disagree with that kind of theology. So they want to take it in that direction, that what you get is people attacking the idea that the church and its ministers should be rewarded, should be prosperous, should be driving around in Rolls Royces, that there's some people who find that distasteful, but that's a matter of taste. And so why should these churches be treated any differently than a church that's a storefront on a street corner, in terms of the kind of scrutiny that's applied by the Senate Finance Committee or the IRS, that the prosperity gospel is a legitimate theology and should not be punished? That's their argument.
Well, Juan, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Farai.
NPR senior correspondent Juan Williams, he was at member station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Now we've got a closer look at prosperity gospel with Reverend Stephen Epps. He's a professor of religion and philosophy at Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn. Glad to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So, Professor, let's listen to a little bit of Creflo Dollar talking about God and money.
Sure.
See, it's easy for a person to sit back who ain't never been there. It's easy for you to say that God don't want you rich, but for some folks, God is the only way out of their lack poverty situation, and he is a father that wants you whole in every area of your life, but he also wants you to have money in your pocketbook so you can have authority in this world.
That's compelling, no doubt. What's wrong with it, if anything?
Well, if we can sort of unmuddy the waters for your listeners, the prosperity gospel posits that financial and material wealth is perhaps an external sign that God's favor and grace is on the believer's life. In the theological world, that does raise some eyebrows because the question is then, for what reason do we worship and praise God? And I never forget that Roger Lestrange said, he who serves God for money will serve the devil for better wages. So it seems to me that the prosperity gospel is ultimately trying to figure out, is God, to what degree is God complicit in the success and failure of my life? And that's a very important question to ask theologically. And I don't know if there's anything necessarily wrong with that particular discussion. But I would add that it does have tremendous potential because it does put financial and economic issues in the mix of the theological discussion. And that's very important. And it's very different from the civil rights movement that particularly dealt with socio-political issues disconnected from financial and economic matters. So it has tremendous potential.
Now, tithes and offerings are common practices, not just in churches, but in synagogues, mosques, you know, any number of places of worship. What's the difference between a tithe and what some people are looking at as potential giving that goes straight into the pockets of the minister?
Well, again, as Mr. Williams discussed, one could make a viable argument in saying that this is a matter of faith, tithing and giving above the tithe, even if it goes into the minister's pocket. See, what's really at stake is two questions. To what degree, whenever you're talking about church-state relations, to what degree do I abdicate my rights as a citizen when I'm exercising my faith, even as it pertains to my giving and giving for large homes, mansions, yachts? To what degree do I abdicate my citizenship when I am a part of a parish ministry as a parishioner? And I think, I don't know necessarily if we can answer that question from an outside point of view. It's really up to the individual to hold the preacher or the pastor or the parish ministry that he or she is a member accountable to where the money is going and the expenditures of that money.
Are you saying then that there should be no, because part of this is tax law, and that there should be no hand of the government in saying, well, you know, okay, you are asking people for this extraordinary amount of money. You're saying that you deserve a tax-exempt status because it's going to the, you know, the religious good, but if it's going into your pocket. And let me just frame this around some interviews that Creflo Dollar has given. Minister Creflo Dollar, who heads the World Changers Church International in Atlanta, the mm-hmm. Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported in 2006 his church took in $69 million. And he says in interviews that he's got plenty of investments and book deals that get him individual money, but the church did buy him a Rolls Royce that he uses for official functions. How do you parse out the difference between that individual money and the money that is being given to the church, given that the church itself has a tax-exempt status, which relies on a certain construction of where that money's going?
Well, that's a difficult question, and I would respond by using the words of Tertullian, who says that the image of Caesar is money, the image of God is man. Give money to Caesar, give yourself to God. If, in fact, that these churches, these mega churches or the pastors owe money to the government, then the government should employ every reasonable and responsible and legal effort to retrieve the money. But if the Senate, and I agree with Kenneth Copeland that that's an IRS issue, but if the Senate Finance Committee is going to reconsider whether or not the churches who have amassed tremendous resources should be tax exempt, then that's going to be a difficult argument for them to make, particularly in America, when the wealthiest of Americans and corporations are given every single opportunity to exploit tax loopholes, receive tax incentives, tax benefits, and the like. So I would certainly say that the government really, in this particular matter, doesn't have any moral authority or moral indignation, considering that billions of dollars go unaccounted for at the federal level due to waste, pork barrel spending, and bureaucratic incompetence. So I would use the words of Jesus here as it pertains to the government in this matter. You know, before you try to get the toothpick out of your brother's eye, you should get the plank out of your own.
Well, Professor Epps, thank you so much.
Thank you kindly.
Professor Stephen Epps is a professor of religion and philosophy at Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn, New York. He joined us from our New York studios. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. A roof over one's head. It's a basic human right according to the United Nations. But the kind of roof you have and whether you own it or something else entirely. America's economy is wobbly. Bad mortgage lending has put people in jeopardy. How will that affect how and where you live? Well, all this month on News and Notes, we're focusing on housing from a consumer perspective. Some of the news is tough. Many American households are at risk of foreclosure. Homes are selling for less than they used to, which you think would be a plus for ready buyers, but a lot of potential buyers can't get the credit to purchase a home. Black communities are also grappling with lending bias, redlining, and gentrification. Here to give us the big picture, we've got Raphael Bostic. He's an associate professor at the School of Policy Planning and Development at the University of Southern California. He's also the director of the USC's Master of Real Estate Development degree program. Also joining us, Lynette Calfani-Cox of themoneycoach.net. She's a personal finance expert who's appeared on shows like Dr. Phil and the Oprah Winfrey Show. She's also written several books. Her latest is Your First Home, The Smart Way to Get It and Keep It. Raphael, Lynette, welcome.
Good to be here.
Thank you for having me.
So, Raphael, give us a snapshot of what's going on in the housing market today.
Housing market is very weak. There are a couple of things that are going on. You alluded to the credit crunch, and we've seen the lending community, by and large, cut off the credit that was making housing affordable for a lot of households. And that what that's meant is that we have a glut of properties on the market that weakens the price power. And in addition, a lot of the folks who got into those initial mortgages using some of the alternative mortgage products have found that those products didn't really work for them and that they're struggling to meet those payments, having to consider foreclosure, default, reworking, and that also has weakened the housing market. So the overall picture is pretty weak, particularly in high-cost markets, but it's weak very much across the board.
Now, when you say weak, is this something that's hurting, say, the big mortgage lenders and the investment banks or neighborhoods or both, and how?
It's hurting all of them. It's hurting the banks and the investors because they were expecting returns, and the defaults and delinquencies we're seeing are eating away at those at rates that no one was really expecting, at least no one at the banks were. In terms of the homeowners, foreclosure and loss of housing is always very painful. It's always disruptive and a traumatic experience. And then for neighborhoods, what we're seeing in terms of where these foreclosures are is that they're concentrated in particular areas. And those areas where we see a hollowing out of the homeownership and of the residents, residential occupancy, that has its own negative spillover effects that we all will wind up having to face and deal with at the community level.
Lynette, you are someone who's an expert in really talking to people directly about how their finances work, but give us a little bit of the big picture in terms of how African-American families and neighborhoods have been a part of the housing market, some of the challenges that we faced, and, you know, some of the ways that we might bring a little bit of baggage from the past into, you know, the transactions we make today.
Well, I think there's no question that the African-American market has been disproportionately hit by the mortgage meltdown that we saw that began in August of 2007 and has, you know, now continued into 2008 and is being manifested in the credit crunch. When you look at the types of loans that African-Americans in particular receive, for instance, there is pretty much uniform belief and statistics to back it up that groups as varied as the Federal Reserve, the Center for Responsible Lending, the Consumer Federation of America, they've all done studies and have statistics that show, for instance, that African Americans, black women in particular, were 2 to 3 times more likely to get subprime loans or predatory loans than their white counterparts. And that's, frankly, regardless of the person's credit. I think in years past, people would be steered into high-cost loans. And the rationale, the justification, if you will, was always, well, of course they have to pay more to get a loan. They have to have a higher interest rate because they have bad credit. But what we're seeing now is that many people who, frankly, had quite good credit still wound up with subprime loans and or predatory loans. And the spillout that we've seen now that's really become quite a drag on the economy overall is obviously getting a lot more attention because it's not just an issue confined to minority communities. Indeed, millions and millions of homeowners all across the country at every income level, at every neighborhood and community in some way are being impacted by this. I tell people all the time because I hear from both sides, both individuals who've been badly hurt by the mortgage meltdown and are having problems refinancing or selling or are facing the threat of foreclosure. Those people clearly are in dire straits. But then I also talk to consumers who say, listen, I'm doing quite well for myself and I'm okay, thank you very much. And I don't see why I should have to, you know, have financial problems because the next guy or my neighbor down the road didn't pay his mortgage or didn't read his loan documents carefully or et cetera, et cetera. And what I tell them both is that we're all in this together. Surely there is blame to be apportioned here because in many cases, lenders were, dare I say, reckless in terms of determining who should really qualify for a mortgage. Certainly some consumers did stretch and overreach and try to take on more mortgage than they could truly afford. Obviously, Wall Street banks were getting rich off of mortgage-backed securities, selling and packaging loans and then you know, selling those in the secondary market. So obviously too few questions were asked there.
But let me get Raphael into this. You know, with all the things Lynette is saying, it sounds as if there's a situation where we were just doing what we are supposed to do, meaning Americans were chasing the American dream of owning a home. And people did many things to get it that may not have been smart.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, one of the issues is that we haven't sent the message that home ownership really isn't a right. It is a privilege, and it comes with costs, obligations, and burdens. And collectively, our society has not placed homeownership in a position such that people who are chasing homeownership actually understand that there are potential consequences. And I did want to actually just comment on the issue about this being concentrated in the black community. That actually is true, and it's true in terms of what types of mortgage products you get, but it's also true in the context of the foreclosure problem. So some research that I've done would suggest that even after you control for credit quality and all those sorts of issues, foreclosure is much more prevalent in lower income and minority communities. And we don't really know why. You know, some of it is certainly steering. Some of it is also, I think, a lower level of sophistication in terms of financial literacy in the black community, and some of it actually has to do, I think, with the with the regulatory structure, which provides incentives for banks to stay away from communities to some extent that they know less about.
Let me just reintroduce our topic. We're talking about the housing market, the big picture overview, and it's the start of our month-long series on housing. It's NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea, and we were just hearing from Raphael Bostic, professor at the School of Policy Planning and Development at the University of Southern California. We've also got Lynette Calthani-Cox of themoneycoach.net, author of Your First Home, The Smart Way to Get It and Keep It. So, Lynette, when you think about these big picture issues, let's transition a little bit into the practicalities for individuals, and role play with both of you a couple of scenarios. You're someone who bought a house a couple years ago, thought that you were doing the right thing in terms of getting a loan, and then you find out, well, gosh, my loan is a subprime loan. What do you do now, Lynette?
Well, first, let me say that just having a subprime loan in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing, was not necessarily meant to be punitive to borrowers. Subprime really just refers to a category of borrowers who did not meet the upper tier qualifications for any bank's lending requirements. In other words, maybe they didn't have the highest credit score, maybe they didn't have a sufficient down payment, etc. If you didn't meet those qualifications, then you were put into a category called non-prime or subprime. The problem is if you have a predatory loan or a loan that has onerous rates and terms, very high interest rates, high fees attached to it, excessive prepayment penalties, perhaps a balloon feature would make it difficult. Any of those things would make it difficult for you to either sell or refinance. The conventional wisdom is clearly if you've had, say, an adjustable rate mortgage that is about to reset on you, or if you had a mortgage that for whatever reason had some terms that were untenable, clearly the opportunity is there to for some to try to refinance into a fixed rate product, something that is less financially detrimental to you. The problem, though, is that because of the ongoing credit crunch, not everybody can. People are willing, certainly, but not everybody can, in fact, refinance. And the shame of it is that we're seeing so much done to help the corporate sector. Everything from, the Federal Reserve giving the $30 billion loan assistance and guarantee to JPMorgan Chase for the buyout of Bear Stearns, to the Federal Reserve opening its discount window to Wall Street banks, as was not the custom before, to offer hundreds of billions of dollars in loans, to just today, the Senate really late yesterday approving a so-called $15 billion housing package, which included, in fact, $6 billion in tax breaks for home builders. I find a lot of people are saying, oh, I don't want to reward the bad behavior of homeowners who did the wrong thing allegedly and didn't read their documents or made imprudent decisions. Why should we, quote unquote, bail out homeowners? And my question is, well, why should we bail out home builders? If they speculated as much as some homeowners and individual investors did, they engaged in overbuilding. And that's part of the problem as well.
Well, let me get Raphael into this again. When you hear Lynette talking about who should get the benefit of government funds that are used to leverage a change in the industry, what exactly, if you're a homeowner who's in trouble or if you're someone who's wanting to buy a home, what's on the horizon for you in terms of positive things that might actually change your situation? Are there any of these structural changes from the government or from lenders that might benefit individual home buyers or homeowners?
Well, for the home buyer group, I think the biggest change is going to be a much more rigorous application of underwriting standards. So the likelihood that you'll get into a mortgage that you'll learn 2 or 3 years later you can't afford is much lower now. Now, it comes with its cost because that means that you can't afford as much a house today as you could a year ago, but it's better to get into a house that you're going to stay in than to get into a house and figure out you have problems. for the home seller side, if you're in a home now and you're in a situation where you're looking at the prospect of being upside down, either because you're in a predatory loan or because you're in a loan where you plan to refi and the market is not going to let you do that anymore, you've got a limited set of options. One of them is to go to your bank or go to a credit counselor and say, look, this is my situation. I can afford this amount, and let's see what we can do. Many credit counselors will be able to work with you if they've got enough scale. They can go to banks. They can revise and try to get those contracts revised and get you into a mortgage product that is more useful. The federal government, through some of their insurance programs and some of the proposals right now, are setting up some funds that are going to be available to help in that restructuring. And so there may still be options in that regard. In terms of who we bail out, these are political questions, and the interests here are extremely powerful. I think the Federal Reserve in particular has been concerned about the housing difficulties spilling over into other parts of the market. We've seen that in terms of it's more difficult to do mergers and acquisitions of just general unrelated to housing interests. We've seen it affect other types of real estate. And I think they're concerned about a general financial collapse. But the general point about home owners should be making home owners reach some of the and receive some of the benefit, I think, is a good one.
Lynette, sort of to wrap things up, when you think about Black neighborhoods in particular, there are a lot of different challenges which have to do sometimes with people, reaching that dream, buying that house, but then not having a lot of money to keep the house up, pay, the taxes on the house and do the maintenance. What do people need to know about keeping a house, not just buying it?
Well, one of the things that Raphael said earlier, I think, can't be emphasized enough, which is that homeownership isn't just a right automatically. There are responsibilities that go along with it. That's why I called my new book, Your First Home, The Smart Way to Get It and Keep It, to try to keep people out of foreclosure. The big things they have to realize are that, there's a lot of rules, what I call the seven commandments of home ownership, that you just absolutely must do to keep a home. Obviously, you have to pay that mortgage. You have to keep up with your property taxes. You have to make sure that you manage the equity in your home appropriately and not use your house as an ATM, as had been done in the past. You have to keep up with maintenance issues. You have to know what's going on in your neighborhood because, yes, what the neighbor down the street does, especially if it results in a decline in his property value, does in fact impact yours as well. So all of these things require a certain amount of education. And unfortunately, in African American communities and indeed in the larger community, we just do not teach people enough about this dream. Yes, we all say it's a great thing to achieve home ownership. I support it. Many, obviously, others do as well. But we haven't told, especially first-time homebuyers, that at the other side of the rainbow, once you get to fulfill that dream, there is a nasty four-letter word called debt. And if you don't manage your mortgage debt properly, if you don't do the wise things that you should do with regard to a mortgage, it can really get you into a lot of trouble.
Well, Lynette and Raphael, good advice, and we'll keep on trucking with our housing series. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with personal finance coach and author Lynette Calfani-Cox. She spoke with us from member station WBGO in Newark, New Jersey, and Raphael Bostic, associate professor at the School of Policy Planning and Development at the University of Southern California. He joined us here in our NPR West studios. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's time again for a look at the week in sports with our very own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. This week it's all about college basketball, but how are the athletes doing academically? Well, that's one of the topics I wanted to talk about with our round ball guru, New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden. Hey, Bill.
Hey, the great Tony Cox. How are things out there?
Down there in Florida having a good time, aren't you?
As well, stunning and funning, as Walt Frazier would say.
We're down to the Final Four in college basketball, Bill, but here's something interesting. The Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sports at the University of Central Florida, not far from you, has issued a report on the graduation rates for NCAA basketball teams that went to the big tournament this year. And surprise, surprise, there is a large gap between the number of white athletes who graduate and the number of black athletes who graduate. Now, only three schools in the survey, Davidson College, a tiny school in North Carolina, and Stanford and Washington State, actually graduated more black players than they did white players. In fact, Davidson graduated 100% of its black players and only half of its white players. But these schools clearly are the exceptions, Bill Roden. The study says the graduation gap is something like 20% higher for white players than black players overall. That's troubling, isn't it?
Troubling, Tony. You know, one of the things that LabCheck finds is 61% of the tournament teams graduated 70% or more of the white players, but only 30% of the black players. And, you know, I guess there are a lot of variables you take into consideration. Transfers, you know, guys going to the league, leaving school early. But I think the larger, we can't really skate around this. The larger problem is, I think, a combination of schools taking players who, you know, may or may not really have a great chance of doing well there, and parents and children and their kids choosing places that probably are not for them academically, but basically choosing it just to play basketball. And this really has to change, Tony. How do we get? I don't know, but this really has to change.
Well, you know, one factor cited by the survey is the fact that black athletes often leave school early for the NBA. I think you just made reference to that. We could spend hours, Bill, debating the benefit versus risk assessment of leaving early. But do you think you really need a college degree if you can make millions right now?
I think so. I mean, clearly the first answer is no. You know, we're all sitting here trying to think about how to pay our kids' tuition. You say, oh, yeah, a million would be great. But I really think that going through a four-year process of earning your degree and meeting people at the university and resources, learning how to think critically, I just think that as a general rule of thumb, going through a four-year or five-year process of a college education, I think is a great thing and should be a goal.
This is something that was interesting, I thought. The survey says black athletes graduate at a significantly higher rate than black students in general.
Yeah.
And that goes for male and female athletes as well, especially for the women whose graduation rate is 72% compared to only 48% for non-athlete co-eds.
Yeah,
it's a lot of numbers. Does it surprise you?
No, it doesn't, because there's an infrastructure and apparatus around the college athlete. It's almost like about two or three safety nets, tutors, layers of tutors, making it really difficult for you to bail out. A lot of times that help is not given to the regular student, you know, just a regular African-American student. Why? Because you're not a financial chit to the
you're
university.
You're not making a contribution to the university's coffers.
Yeah.
Before we get away from college basketball, really quickly, Final Four this weekend, who are you picking?
I like, knock on wood, I like Memphis to win it all.
Memphis.
I really think they're playing really well if Calipari could just kind of keep it all together. And I like them playing Kansas for the national championship.
Oh, you're going underdog all the way then, aren't you? All right, one more thing before we get away this week. I know that Isaiah Thomas may be out of a job right now with the New York Knicks. They've brought in former Indiana Pacers boss Donnie Walsh. So if you are Isaiah, do you start cleaning out your office right now, get that picture and that dead plant out of the corner?
Yeah, I start boxing it up. I may move to a smaller office. There's a level of loyalty that Walsh has for Isaiah and also that Dolan. So I think that they'll find him a place within the organization, but it's not going to be on that bench and it's not going to be in the front office. Those, you know, the Isaiah Thomas era has pretty much officially ended.
So if you're Isaiah, do you still want to even be associated with the Knicks after all of this?
He probably needs to, you know, wipe the slate clean and go somewhere else. But I just think there's a big pride factor here that would want him, that he just want to be part of cleaning up the mess that he in part helped to create. But, you know, Tony, this stuff has been going on for decades. It just didn't start with Isaiah.
Well, that's true. Time's run out for us, so we'll have to talk about the MVP the next time we get together. Bill, have a good time down in Florida. Don't get sunburned.
Tony, you take care.
That was NPR's Tony Cox speaking with our regular sports commentator, William C. Roden. Roden is a sports columnist for the New York Times and author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. Most of us want to control our health, but sometimes it controls us. An unexpected symptom or illness pops up, and then we're on the hunt for a solution. Many women will end up confronting the issue of uterine fibroids. They're non-cancerous growths that can cause pain and hurt a woman's chances to have children. African Americans get fibroids at a much higher rate than white women. For more on how to recognize and treat fibroids, we've got Dr. Elizabeth Stewart. She's a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. She's also written a complete guide to understanding uterine fibroids. Hello, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you for having me with you.
So let's start with what exactly they are.
Okay. Fibroids are non-cancerous tumors. They're growths of muscle within the uterine wall. And sometimes they can be the size of a dime, and because of their location, they give you severe symptoms. And rarely they can get to be the size of a basketball before they're recognized.
That sounds pretty horrific.
It can be. It's amazing how much difficulty they can give to women, in general, women can have severe menstrual bleeding, the kind of bleeding that keeps you home from work or keeps you from being able to do your daily activities, or they can press on a lot of body structures. And they are very common, and it's surprising that so few women know that they have fibroids and that their symptoms may be related to them.
Now, research shows that about 25% of women in America are going to show some symptoms of fibroids, but they occur a lot more often in black women than white women. How much more often and why do scientists think that is?
Well, the first thing is that studies suggest that at least 70 to 80% of all black women will have clinically recognized fibroids, and that's a huge number. I think that we don't really understand why black women are at greater risk. Most of the studies have suggested that some of the risk factors like age that you have children or contraceptive use or diet don't really explain that disparity. And in fact, there's some newer research that's suggesting that certain genes may predispose you to uterine fibroids. And interestingly, most of the prior genetic work has been done in Scandinavia. And so the genes that have been identified to be fibroid genes really don't appear to be expressed in African American women.
So if you are having some of these symptoms, you go into the doctor, you're diagnosed with fibroids, what are the treatment options?
Well, there are a whole range of treatment options, and I think that that's important for women to know because for so many years, women were either offered hysterectomy or offered nothing, either live with it or go ahead and take the big jump to hysterectomy, and that there are some medical treatments that can be effective for women. And some women, it can be as simple as thinking about using birth control pills or other hormonal preparations. There are some minimally invasive surgeries, so sometimes the fibroid is in a location where you can get it out with a small telescope and you can be back at work the next day. And there are increasingly some minimally invasive options even for women who have big fibroids or multiple fibroids. And the two most commonly used ones are uterine artery embolization or MRI-guided focused ultrasound.
So when you use words like embolization and ultrasound, you're talking about ways of kind of cutting off the blood flow. Is that correct?
Uterine artery embolization really cuts off the blood flow. The focused ultrasound works slightly differently because it's actually a procedure that doesn't require any incisions. The high-intensity ultrasound goes through the abdominal wall and is able to destroy the fibroid. So it really doesn't affect the blood supply, but it can zero in and destroy the fibroid tissue.
It sounds like there's been a lot of advances in how people deal with this.
There have been, and I think that many women need to know better what their options are, and even many doctors are not aware of all of the ongoing research. For so many years, we just kind of relied on hysterectomy to fix all of the problems, and I think as women are busy in the workforce and doing more activities with their family and working, that the benefit of minimally invasive treatments is really evident.
Suppose that you're someone who's had fibroids and you've had them removed. Is there a chance they're going to come back? And if so, what do you do then?
Yeah, that's the worst part. And that's one of the reasons why I think research has to focus in on understanding the disease and preventing it. Because particularly in African American women, where 75% of the women get the disease, seems to make much more sense to try to prevent it than to try to keep dealing with it. And part of the problem, or part of the issue, is when you get a recurrence and where you are in your life. Most women get relief of their symptoms at menopause. So if you've had a surgery, say, in your early 30s, and then you don't develop problems again till your mid-40s, then usually something minimally invasive can tide you through to menopause. Or at that point in your life, sometimes hysterectomy is a good option for you. I think that the more worrisome problem is when you've had such severe problems, you've developed them in your early 20s, you've already had to have a major surgery, and then by your mid to late 20s, you have new symptoms. And I think that that's where we absolutely need even better solutions than we have now.
Well, Dr. Stewart, thanks so much.
Thank you for your time.
Dr. Elizabeth Stewart is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. Her book is Uterine Fibroids, The Complete Guide. She joined us from her office at the Mayo Clinic in Minneapolis. It's Thursday, and that means letter time. Here to lend a hand is NPR producer and editor Christopher Johnson. Hey, Christopher.
Hey, Farai. How you feeling?
I am just dandy and ready to hear the listeners speak. What do you got?
Well, yesterday you went old school on us. You talked with an 87-year-old man named Clarence Garrett. Now, Clarence is kind of my hero, mainly because the brother just graduated from college. The whole interview was a hoot, especially the part when you asked Mr. Garrett about graduation day.
Woo! The best day of my life, I guess. Life doesn't get any better. Life doesn't get any better. With my family there or my friends cheering me on, I felt like I was 16 years old. What a day, what a day!
And Pozell heard Mr. Garrett from up in Ithaca, New York, and she wrote to say, "What a delightful human being. I feel privileged to share the planet with him. Please, please, someone make a documentary about him so that he can continue to charm and inspire future generations."
Also this week, we covered the latest with Mumia Abu-Jamal. The former Black Panther was convicted in 1982 of killing Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. Abu-Jamal has been behind bars ever since. A federal court recently decided he should get a new sentencing hearing. So I spoke with an activist fighting for Mumia's release. I also talked to Daniel Faulkner's widow, Maureen. Craig Brookins in Raleigh, North Carolina, tuned in for those conversations and wrote us this. "This is the first time I've heard a report that featured both sides of the Mumia story. While the interview with the victim's wife did not change my view that Mumia was unjustly convicted, it did provide further insight into the tragedy of the entire situation."
And we wrapped up our series on Blacks and mental health on Monday. We talked about suicide and how it impacts Black men in particular. Lori Lucky in Seattle says she was grateful for the segment. Lori also wrote us this. My son had a friend who committed suicide at age 28 after suffering from clinical depression for several years. We had no idea he was depressed. His neighborhood friends, such as my son, were devastated when he shot himself in a restroom of Harborview Hospital, Seattle's main trauma center. The support groups mentioned in your program could assist so many people. It's a blessing that they've come into existence.
Also last week on our Sports Bloggers Roundtable, we talked about basketball star LeBron James. He's on the cover of this month's Vogue magazine posing with supermodel Gisele Bündchen. LeBron's pose makes him look kind of like King Kong. At least that's what some folks have said, including our listener Joshua Croson in Lakewood, Washington. Joshua says Vogue doesn't just pose a black man as the world's most infamous ape and Bündchen as the most famous damsel in distress. The image also evokes early 20th century images of black men as aggressive, dangerous, and sexually driven when in contact with white women. Birth of a Nation, anyone? If this isn't blatant racist imagery, then I don't know what is.
And last but never least, the listener love. This one comes from Lucinda Vale in Riverview, Michigan. I'm a middle-aged Caucasian woman, and I always listen to your show. I'm grateful for the insight that your program offers. Having grown up in a traditional white family, I had little/no knowledge of issues that are unique to the black community. While I still can't relate to these issues, I am at least more aware. Thank you.
Lucinda, thanks for the note. And one of the things I enjoy about hosting this show is that although my family taught me plenty about black history and culture, I learn more here each day. Thanks again.
And that's it for Lettuce, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Now, when you get there, you'll find a whole bunch of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes, and that way we'll know your letter is for us.
And one more favor. Be sure to tell us where you're writing from and help a brother and sister out with pronouncing your name, okay?
Christopher, thanks.
You got it, Farai.